to some colleagues, not me.
Okay, finally, for this month and year, business combinations under common control. Julia.
Thank you, Hans. Good afternoon. So we have three papers for the discussion at this meeting. Agenda paper 23A discusses our review of other projects of the board and interpretations committee to identify any issues that may need to be considered in the scope of this project. Agenda paper 23B discusses two issues that are related to the scope of our project and remain unresolved and asks the board for decisions. Agenda paper 23C discusses initial considerations in determining the method of accounting for transactions within the scope of the project. We have also discussed those considerations with the ASAF and Emerging Economies Group earlier this month, and we will share with you their feedback. That paper is for information only, but we would welcome your initial reactions, questions, and observations. With that, I will hand it over to Satenik.
Thank you. So agenda paper 23A provides an overview of the issues related to the scope of the BCUCC project that the staff has identified in other projects of the board and the interpretations committee. This paper is for information only, and there are no questions for the board. The staff have reviewed submissions received by Interpretations Committee, as well as the feedback received on the 2011 agenda consultations, IFRS 3 PIR, and exposure draft on definition of the business. The staff have identified several issues related to the scope of the BCUCC project in submissions received by the committee. Some of these issues remained unresolved and have also been raised subsequently by securities regulator. No issues have been identified in other projects reviewed by the staff. The issues that remain unresolved relate to transactions that meet the definition of a business combination, but it is not clear whether it is under common control. The first scenario is illustrated in Figure 1 on page 4 of paper 23A. The committee was asked to consider a group restructuring involving the formation of a new entity, NewCo, to facilitate the sale of part of the group. So the controlling party P formed a NewCo and transferred entity A and B to that NewCo in preparation of NewCo's IPO. In this scenario, some stakeholders questioned whether P's control over NewCo is transitory, in which case the scope exclusion in IFRS 3 would not apply, and the transaction would need to be accounted for applying the acquisition method. The second scenario is illustrated in Figure 2 on page 6. Of paper 23A. The transaction illustrated is the same transaction as I just described, apart from the fact that the acquisition of entities A and B by NewCo is conditional on occurrence of the IPO. So if the IPO doesn't go ahead, the transaction is not effective. In this scenario, some parties argue that such a condition is relevant to the analysis. Therefore, the IPO takes place before the acquisition. Under this view, the combination is not a business combination under common control. So scope exclusion in IFRS 3 does not apply, and the combination is accounted for under the acquisition method. Others argue that the condition is not relevant to the analysis. However, there are also different views as to whether P's control is transitory. So if it is transitory, then it's normal business combination and acquisition method is applied. If it is not, then it's a BCUCC and the scope exclusion in IFRS 3 apply. The staff analyzed whether this transition should be included in the scope of the BCUCC project in the next paper, paper 23B, in this meeting. Another scenario discussed by the committee relates to a transaction that is under common control but does not meet the definition of a business combination, because neither of the combining entities can be identified as the acquirer. This is issue 3 in agenda paper 23A and is illustrated in figure 3 on page 8. In October 2017, the board already tentatively decided that the scope of the project will include transactions under common control in which a reporting entity obtains control of one or more businesses, regardless of whether IFRS 3 would identify the reporting entity as the acquirer if IFRS 3 were applied to the transaction. Accordingly, this transaction is included in the scope of the BCUCC project. Finally, in 2017, the committee discussed two submissions that asked the committee to clarify whether the scope exclusion in IFRS 3 applies to other transactions under common control. So one submission raised a general question as to whether IFRS standards provide a general exception or exemption from applying the requirement in a particular standard to common control transactions. The committee issued a tentative agenda decision where it noted that unless the standard specifically excludes common control transactions from its scope, an entity applies the applicable requirement in the standard to common control transactions. The committee will discuss the comments received on the tentative agenda decision at the future meeting. Another submission asked whether the scope exclusion in IFRS 3 applies to an acquisition of an associate from an entity under common control. The committee discussed the issue at its June and September 2017 meetings, but did not issue an agenda decision. Some members argued that it may be premature for the committee to issue an agenda decision pending developments in the BCUCC project. As discussed in Agenda Paper 23, scope of the project, from October 2017, the staff will consider an interaction between accounting for transactions in the scope of the BCUCC project and accounting for other transactions under common control as the BCUCC project progresses. Now, if you have any questions relating to this paper.
Just once more of a comment than a question. I'm focusing on, I guess, issue two, not an IPO. Question we don't have to answer it now, I think, just put in the work plan. Why is an IPO so special? There's other ways to dispose of operations. You could sell them, you could spin them off, you could do them piecemeal, and so on. And so, I mean, it seems to me the issue is you want to dispose of them, and that's why you formed NewCo. And I just don't know, should be limited solely by an IPO. And then plan as opposed to a spinoff. I'll sell it, you know, private sale or whatever. We don't have to answer it now, it's just an observation. I think there's all sorts of transaction structures. Okay, something to think about.
If there are no considerations, we can move to Agenda Paper 23B. So Agenda Paper 23B is like about the scope of the project, and as you know, the board decided that this project should consider business combination under common control and group restructuring, and the board in October clarified that initial decision. But in October, the board also acknowledged that there are some application questions on one of the elements of the scope decision, which is business combination under common control. And in particular, there are application questions related to the description of business combination under common control. And these application questions, as just discussed in Agenda Paper 23A, refer to the meaning of transitory control and to situation where a combination is conditional to the occurrence of an IPO. And these application questions focus on whether a transaction is or is not a business combination under common control. So in all these circumstances, answering to that these specific application question will draw the line between business combination and business combination under common control. And this line, this distinction, is important today because it determines whether the transaction must be accounted under the acquisition methods or whether there is an accounting policy choice. However, as the project progresses, this distinction might not remain relevant. If the board decided that some or all business combination under common control must be accounted for under the acquisition methods as set out in IFRS 3. Instead, the important distinction might become the one between transactions that are accounted for under the acquisition method and transactions that are accounted for applying another method. So what we are recommending today is that the board should, instead of focusing on the distinction between business combination and business combination under common control, the board should focus on filling the gap in the accounting requirement for business combination. So considering in the scope transaction where application question exists as to whether the common control is transitory, and transactions that are conditional to a future sale, such as in an IPO. And that means that the board will consider the unresolved scenarios brought to the committee, but instead of answering the question whether these transactions are or are not under common control, we suggest the board to focus on the core, on the fundamental question all these stakeholders were asking, which is, how do I account for that transaction? Mm. And this is our question for you, sir. Do you agree with our recommendation? And the summary of our recommendation is on paragraph 3 of the paper, so agenda paper 23B. Even if we split the question for you into two different questions. Before I open the floor for discussion, I just would like to mention that, as Julia said, we discussed this staff recommendation with Emerging Economy Group and the accounting, the ASAF, and the feedback from both groups was quite consistent. So both groups expressed their support for the staff recommendation. So they agree that the project should not focus on the distinction between business combination and business combination under common control, but instead should focus on the accounting treatment, the accounting requirements in the industry, this scenario. And also both groups expresses their support for the decision of clarifying the scope that the board made in October. And I will just add that, as a side note, some at this meeting, some stakeholders also suggested that, given that the scope of the project is now broader than just business combination under common control, the title of the project is not longer entirely accurate, but we will consider this feedback. And with that, I hand it over to the board.
Sue?
I think I agree with where you're going, and I thought the analysis in these papers was very helpful, by the way, so thank you for that. I just want to double check, though, what I'm agreeing to, just to make sure I have understood properly. So if I look, for example, at the IS 28 question that came to the Interpretations Committee, what you're suggesting here is we're not going to focus on that per se, but when we do the BCUCC project and we sort of land where we think we're going to land, we then sort of stop and test what the consequence of that would be in some of these situations to decide whether there's more we need to do.
I think it's not so much about sort of testing that, but I think as we will develop the requirements for transactions that are within the scope of this project, we will consider requirements in the existing standards, and we will consider sort of any recommendation for this project in the broader context and to see whether this all sort of makes sense, given where other standards are.
Yeah, I think I agree.
Gary?
Thank you. I have two comments and one question. They all sort of come up on page 8. I agree transitional control should not be central to this thing. We should focus on, the transaction itself and not transition. That said, instinctively, since we're into an area trying to fill in the gap in the literature, transitional controls definition has been problematic elsewhere. So you're not going to focus. The question is it binary? It's either transitional control and permanent, or is there something in between? Like, we don't know. I think we can proceed as you're suggesting. I just think that's going to come back on us to, what is transit? We agree transitional control is an answer, but where's the line? Permanent, or is there something in between? Second, I think paragraph 27D, I think is not something we actually need to truly focus on, because it says the combination takes effect only if the IPO is successful, and that there's other ways to dispose of my earlier comment. Well, if it's not successful, the transaction doesn't occur, and therefore there's nothing to account for. If it is successful, the time period's relatively short when we can combine it, might be the morning, the IPO, just before we close it. So I don't think that's really a question, that needs focus, unless I'm truly missing something that's in here. But if it's not successful, we didn't have the combination. And then up in question 1B, I understand the second part of it about an external sale.
But what's significant about they're preceded by an external acquisition? Does that mean just moving stuff around to get it to the final point in the permanent company, or I don't quite get what that point is. I don't disagree with it as far as I know, but I don't know what your intention is.
So maybe if we take Gary's questions one by one. So with respect to the transitory, so you're saying you think it will come back to us anyway, and I think I'd just like to reiterate what Anna already said. The reason transitory means today, because the answer to this question determines whether you apply the acquisition method or whether you have a policy choice. But what we're saying that in the future, it might no longer matter if we decide that there is a different dividing line between the acquisition method and the different method, whether control is transitory or not will become completely irrelevant.
Right.
So that's one point.
I'm okay with where we are. I just think we're not going to get out of the room, you know, without having to address it at some point. I think we should proceed as suggested, recognizing, I think, in future feedback, we'll hear about it again.
Certainly, if it remains relevant, we will look at it, and if it becomes irrelevant, we would need.
I think let the world make it relevant. I think we should proceed as we are.
Now, with your comment regarding the IPO, so a couple of thoughts here. So first of all, this IPO scenario seems to be pretty pervasive in particular jurisdictions based on the analysis performed by IFRIC staff earlier with regards to relevant submissions. And that question came to us more than once, and this question was raised by securities regulators. So it seems that, you know, this particular question is quite an important and pervasive issue. But the other consideration also is that if you think about it, so the central question in that scenario is, does the condition matter? If my business combination is conditional, does it impact my analysis or not? And it seems to me that this scenario could only work in an IPO context, because if you have a buyer, you already know whether the buyer buys your business or not. So that condition can only relate to an IPO. But again, we will think about other scenarios as we go.
You're talking about the accounting for NewCo in here, right? We're not talking the ultimate parent, talking NewCo's combining.
Yes.
But NewCo doesn't combine if you don't dispose of this thing. You're using IPO, I assert it's... there's more ways to get rid of it.
So NewCo would only do the acquisition if it's also doing the IPO.
Yeah, it probably happens the day of the closing. You know, you do stuff pro forma and you put it together, you know, with just before you close or do the transaction, and it's a non-event. It's not like you form it, you spend 3 years trying to IPO it, and then you undo it. I submit these things are relatively short duration things. In any event, it doesn't happen if you're not successful. So therefore, if you did it, you'd probably unwind it, you know, is that's the inference.
I guess if I try to answer that question, I think the question is, in case of a successful IPO, some argue that IPO happens before the transaction. Some argue that IPO happens after the transaction. So even if it is conditional on IPO, some argue that the transaction happens before and not after?
Well, I think it does happen before. It might happen close to simultaneously. I don't know how it happens after. Assuming you lose control, you know, you could IPO 10%, but I'm assuming you lose consolidating control of it. Well, then it's the buyer's, you know, problem, or it's NewCo, it's a standalone new company. It's not the ultimate, the today's parent.
If we take a step back, we're not trying to answer this question at this meeting.
Yeah,
all of us are trying to answer whether it's
in the scope. Yes for comments.
No.
I'm getting
you also raised the question about question 1B, and if you wanted to clarify that.
Well, as we mentioned, we receive like question focus on the meaning of transitory control, and we analyze all this submission, and what we notice is that these questions arise either when an under common control transaction is preceded by an external sale. So some stakeholder argue that the controlling party over all the combining entity is transitory because some entity just went into the group. So this control might be considered transitory. Or some other stakeholder suggested us that the control might be transitory when a common control transaction is followed by an external say, again for the same reason but on a different leg, or other stakeholders suggested as that we this question as to whether the control is transitory or not arise when you have the two situation combined. So an entity or a business went into the group and then immediately after, so another common control transaction happened and immediately after an IPO occur or something.
And by the way, I actually understand, I was just kind of in the middle, it says and or and, you know, so like you had an external acquisition,
yeah,
or you had an external sale. I saw those two unrelated things in one sentence.
We don't have to. This big cover like three situations. So preceded by an external sale, preceded by an external acquisition, followed by an external sale, and as a third scenario, preceded by an external acquisition and followed by an external sale. So it's like three different situations condensed in this point.
Mary?
A few points. One is, overall, I think the approach is the right one in terms of saying let's try to specify the accounting for the defined pool of transactions. I think, though, in terms of communicating about this project and the questions it will answer, I think it should answer more than how do you account for the defined pool of transactions. And I'm going back in part to the previous month's discussion because I think there's a lot of dust that has been raised about what do you do about the ones that are not within the scope of whatever special model, you know, or specific guidance we provide. Because I think that I would expect this project to also say, as the staff has said in some of the papers, that this transaction is not in the scope of what we're addressing because it's already adequately addressed by existing IFRSs, and remove some of the noise that has been put into the system, you know, with people saying it isn't clear what we do for X transaction or Y transaction because of this common control exemption. And I think one of the things the project is trying to do is the common control transaction only applies if it's a business combination and the transaction is under common control. And you're showing that that involves a number of scenarios. But I think some of the things that you go through, we also are going to answer by pointing to the existing relevant accounting. So let's not forget about those other questions we're also going to answer. They're diversity and practice areas that we're going to resolve, not by writing special requirements for them, but by saying the reason we did, you know, in the basis for conclusions, for example, the reason we didn't address this is because we think they're within the scope of extant IFRSs. And I think, Anna Maria, in your paper, there was at least one place where you said this isn't a common control transaction, therefore it would be accounted for as an acquisition. And that's the kind of thing I'm talking about. If you go back to paper 23A, I think there is a question that we'll have to address in terms of where we draw lines about transactions we're addressing. Is you said previously the board decided the project should only address transactions under common control involving transfers of businesses or entities. And I think one of the things that we're going to have to resolve is, and this is not scope, I don't think it's scope creep, is if you have an entity that's not a business, it's accounted for as an acquisition of assets. Okay. And then the question is the acquisition of assets inside a legal entity shell different from an acquisition of assets outside a legal entity shell? Because I think we would say the acquisition of assets outside a legal entity shell, if the assets are not a business, is not in the BizCom under common control scope out that's in IFRS 3. And I think that kind of argumentation about entity, not a business, is what has gotten people, in my view, not appropriately, but there are different views around the world, applying the BizCom scope exception to transfers of assets between entities under common control. So I think if we do address transfers of businesses or entities, and the reason I think we're saying businesses or entities is because we're thinking about entities that are not a business, then we're going to have to address...
No, not really. So I think with respect to businesses versus entities, we pretty much just mirror what is in IFRS 3. Because IFRS 3 does not make a distinction between entities that is a business versus entities that is not a business. IFRS 3 talks about businesses and entities, and that's exactly what we're doing in this project.
Well, I think we have to think about that, because I think if we talk about entities that are not businesses, we're then going to get people pressing on the pressure point. So it matters whether or not I take these assets and put them in a legal entity wrapper or not. Because if I put them in a legal entity wrapper, even though they don't become a business, they suddenly become something that's within the scope of this project.
It does risk expanding the scope quite a lot, though, because that falls back into IFRS 3, essentially.
Well, I think we just have to be clear about what the line, you know, where the lines are, and if that's creating any arbitrage. I'm not trying to say let's answer a whole bunch more, but I think we have to be cautious about that. So I just want to send you back to that language and think about what the implications are. I understand why you said we picked up that language, because it's the existing language in IFRS 3, but I think it's the existing language that has given rise to some practice issues. So let's make sure we try to avoid perpetuating the practice issues that come from entity versus non-entity shell.
We'll definitely think about it, but I guess my sort of immediate concern is that if we were to make a distinction in that in this project, it seems to me we would need to think about replicating a similar distinction in IFRS 3, but we will definitely take this away and have a
think. It's more go away and think about that, and because I think that's one of the big sources of practice problems around this. So let's see if we can address it without starting to write lots and lots of special requirements, because I don't want lots of scope for the other two points, and they're unrelated to that one. Is I think you've done a good explanation about why we shouldn't worry about solving transitory and instead focus on whether or not, what's the word, preceded or followed. But I just wonder if we're just changing words without changing the question, because right now the question about transitory is what do we mean and how long do you have to have held it for it not to be considered transitory control? And if we say preceded or followed, are we going to end up with questions about, well, how long preceded, how long followed? So I'm not sure if we're really changing the discussion by changing the vocabulary. I don't have any objections to characterizing it as preceded and followed instead of transitory, but I think we may just end up circling back to the same set of questions. And then the last thing with Gary was saying, does it really matter whether you dispose of it in an IPO or dispose of it another way? And I think the one where we may have to analyze specifically is if it's through a disposition to shareholders of the entity or the parent, because one of the arguments that I have heard is I was a shareholder in P before, and so the sub was under, you know, my control, and if the parent distributes out shares of the sub, it has the same owners before and after. If it's a distribution of some kind. So the argument there is at least in the immediate post-distribution that's under common control, it's just directly rather than indirectly. So that's, I think, the one place where, Gary, the form of distribution may matter, because an IPO, it won't be under common control after the transaction. Some might argue that in a spin-off, split-off, or, you know, other form of distribution, it is under common control at least until the shares begin trading. So those are things to think about rather than get an answer now.
So I agree with where you've landed. Anna, you said when you were teeing this up that the EEG, one of the members, had warned you about this idea of the idea that perhaps we should rename the project, and their concern was almost the one that sort of came out of Mary's discussion. It was a real concern that by expanding the scope of business combination in a project that was business combinations under common control, there was an implicit assumption we were now expanding what we actually meant in IFRS 3. And I think the big caution that they were expressing is that we would have to, throughout this project, be really, really careful that we didn't end up finding ourselves sucked back into 3, the definitions of 3. And I think it's, take what Mary's saying, but I think that is a big caution that I thought came out of that, that I thought was usefully made.
Okay.
So we can now move to agenda paper 23.
Oh, no, we need the decision.
Oh, sorry.
Another question.
We splitted the recommendation into two different questions, but the key concept is what I have explained. So instead of focusing on the distinction between business combination under common control and business combination not under common control, we should just include these different transactions in the scope of the project. So if you agree, we probably should take the vote on the two questions in okay. one.
So question.
So basically, the recommendation is in paragraph 3, and the question is whether the board agrees to it.
If you're going to ask us to vote on question 1, I guess I do want an initial reaction, at least, to whether you think there's a meaningful difference between transitory versus preceded or followed.
I think Mary's question is a good one. Let's say that you're in scenario 2, mm-hmm. and P bought B 3 years ago, and then sells it to A.
And I think what we're saying is that the main point is that we will consider this transaction as a project, we will consider whether or not it matters how long ago it was, but what we're saying that we are not trying to say whether it's a business combination under common control or not, but instead we will be focusing on what is the appropriate method of accounting for that transaction.
I think question one is asking about a distinction without a difference, so I don't mind if you approach it with that vocabulary, but I think we're going to answer the same question is transitory.
Because you might end up having a different conclusion if it was 6 months ago or 1 week ago or 5 years ago. I think is Mary's point.
Yeah. Or Mary.
But if it is that we use the acquisition method, it doesn't matter.
Yeah.
Therefore,
transaction,
and if you have concluded that, then you may
take it. So I'm okay with this. What Mary's rider is. Obviously, there has to be some time thing inserted. So,
if the accounting's different,
yeah,
if
conditional on getting this timing mm-hmm. right. Yeah. Okay.
So, subject to all those caveats, yeah. Can we vote on question 1?
14.
And then. On page 10.
Are you guys voting?
Are we voting to
Tom?
Tom.
14.
I missed the call.
We should now move to agenda paper 23C, which is the slide deck. So during this last session of the meeting, we would like to provide you an overview of some initial consideration on methods of accounting for transaction in the scope of the project. We will update you on feedback we received from ASAF and EEG member on these initial consideration, and of course we'll give you the opportunity to ask questions and share your initial reaction. So let's quickly go through the slide deck. So as a very first step, we try to identify what are the potential accounting alternatives for transaction in the scope of the project. And in doing so, we primarily refer to the guidance in the conceptual framework, but we also consider the hierarchy in IS 8 and the feedback we receive from outreach. And in particular, we consider IFRS standards dealing with similar or related issue, other standard setters' guidance and accounting literature, and accepted industry practice.
And the alternatives that we initially identify are on slide 7 of the slide deck. So the acquisition method, which is describing IFRS standard, which is the method prescribed for business combination not under common control as an initial alternative. We also identify the so-called predecessor method, which is not described in IFRS standard, but is commonly applied in practice and it is described in some national standard setters' guidance, even if we are aware there are some diversity in practice in how this method is applied. We also identify the so-called fresh start method. Again, this is not described in IFRS standard, but was suggested by some stakeholder during our outreach. And finally, what we called the allocation of cost method, which is basically the method applied to an acquisition of a group of assets where the consideration transfer is allocated to the net assets acquired without recognizing any goodwill. And for today's discussion, we'd like to focus on the acquisition method and on the predecessor method as the starting points of primary alternatives. But of course, we will also consider other methods as the project progresses as needed. Now, the decision process the board will need to go through is the one illustrated on slide 10. And the key question remains, what method or methods should be applied to transaction in the scope of the project? And the board might decide that a single method of accounting should be applied to all the transactions within the scope, or different methods of accounting should be applied to different transactions. And in the latter case, the board will also have to decide how to choose which method to apply to which transaction. Now, we identify two different approaches to selecting the accounting methods. So approach one, which is on slide, illustrated on slide 11, uses the acquisition method as a starting point. And the key question that drives this approach is, are the transactions in the scope of this project substantially different from business combination not under common control? And of course, if the answer to this question is no, we will need to apply a single method to all the transactions in the scope, and this method will be the acquisition method. But if the answer to this question is yes, all the transactions in the scope of this project are different from business combination not under common control, well, we might still decide whether to apply one or more methods to the in-scope transaction, but definitely none of these methods can be the acquisition method. And finally, if we go through the last view, so if the answer to this question is yes, some business combination under common control are different from business combination not under common control, but some other are similar to business combination not under common control, then more than one method should be applied to transaction in the scope of the project, and one of these methods should be the acquisition method. And well, once again, we will need to decide how to draw the line between different transactions, but at least we start with the acquisition method as a starting point. And this is approach one. Approach two, which is in slide 12, uses the predecessor method as a starting point. And the logic here is that all business combinations under common control are different from business combinations not under common control, in that there is no change in the ultimate control over the transfer businesses. So given this continuity of control, some argue that it will normally be appropriate to retain carrying amounts, so to apply the so-called predecessor method. However, in some specific circumstances, using the fair value can provide more useful information. For instance, when the change in the ownership interest in the transfer business is significant. So, and this is approach two, so start with the predecessor method. What I like to note is that according to both approaches, more than one method of accounting is applied to a transaction in the scope of this project. And in both cases, the board will need to determine when is each method appropriate? So in other words, the board will need to identify factors that will determine which method should be applied to a particular transaction. And I will pause in a minute and ask your feedback on this two approach. But before moving, I'll give you an overview of the feedback we receive on these two different approaches from EEG and ASAF member. And first of all, many EEG and ASAF members agree on using existing accounting alternative as a starting point. And a few others suggested that we should consider starting from a blank sheet of paper and develop methods applying the guidance in the conceptual framework. Among those members that agree on starting with existing accounting alternative, there were mixed views as to whether the starting point and starting method should be the acquisition method or the predecessor method. However, the reasons for preferring one method over the other were consistent with those we identify in our presentation, so the concept of continuity or control for preferring the predecessor method as a starting point, and the concept that some business combinations on the common core are similar to normal business combination for preferring the acquisition method as a starting point. And then some members also observe that the two approaches we outline could result into similar actual outcome in terms of accounting requirement for transaction in the scope for the project. So it doesn't really matter which approach you take, the ending result will probably be the same. And in general, there was a general support for considering more than one method of accounting for transaction in the scope of the project, even if some members expressed a strong preference for either the predecessor or the acquisition method. And with that, I'll hand over to you.
Can I just confirm something? You said that some had said that the two methods, the two approaches, would get you to a similar outcome. You won't get a similar outcome applying predecessor and acquisition. You'll get a similar outcome coming at it from acquisition first, to or coming at it from prior case.
Yeah, yeah.
I thought so. I got a little bit confused. Okay.
Tom.
Oh, sorry. So can I just go back to slide 12 for a second? When you say EG, when the change in the ownership interest is significant, so is this where we're talking about non-controlling interests being involved?
Yes.
Okay. And it might be important in assessing the fairness of the transaction and also exactly what you're getting, right, if you're the non-controlling interest.
I don't know if the presence of NCI necessarily helps you to assess whether the transaction is on market terms, if this is your question.
Well, I'm just trying to understand when you say, what are the particular circumstances? One of the things I understood about this is it may matter how it's accounted for in assessing the transaction if I'm a non-controlling interest. And is non-controlling interest one of the circumstances?
Yeah, so basically this slide is saying that under this view, normally you would apply the predecessor method to the business combination under common control because they're different from normal business combinations. But in some exceptional circumstances, you could still apply the acquisition method. And for example, some would argue that you would still apply the acquisition method if your NCI changes significantly as a result of the transaction.
So who gets to choose?
Well, yeah.
No. If we have these two things out there, like, are we going to say if you have a non-controlling interest, you have to do X, or are we going to say, okay, I just was sort of thinking about that, and would it also apply if one of the entities just had a whole pile of outstanding bonds, publicly traded?
I think we are moving to the
discussion about factors rather than the discussion about the
factors.
We are now moving to the next discussion.
What is the factor that makes you
What are the particular circumstances? They put the EG in there, so I was...
This specific example was from the Canadian, Canadian Gap. So we thought it might be useful in that circumstances to mention some specific circumstances, some other standard setter uses to justify the application of the acquisition method. But as I said before, we will discuss about...
Right. Sorry.
And the board can decide something completely different. That's one of the existing examples.
Okay.
Sue?
In terms of initial reactions, my starting position conceptually would be to, and I don't know whether the ultimate outcome is any different, but my head starts with the acquisition method, because if we're thinking about the accounting from the reporting entity's perspective, who's the acquirer, the fact that the ultimate controller hasn't changed to me doesn't really matter, because it's an acquisition is an acquisition is an acquisition from that reporting entity's perspective. So that's my sort of starting point. But that's before you start thinking about, you know, is there any reason from a sort of anti-avoidance type perspective that it might just be, you know, shenanigans of internal shuffling that doesn't really mean too much, or whether there might be cost implications or something like that, because the ultimate consolidated financial statements matter a lot and, you know, they're not going to change. But if you ask me what my anchor is, I think my starting anchor is that.
Mary?
First, a vocabulary, but it impacts the phrasing of approach one and approach two. Is that if I start on slide 11, you're asking the question about whether the transactions are substantially different. And I think maybe rather than focusing on the transactions, I think maybe the question we should be asking is, are the information needs substantially different when you have one versus the other kind, rather than leading with the transactions? Because I think we can spend a lot of time debating the nature of the transaction is different, you know, if it has common ownership involved and what other kind of parties. But I think ultimately the question we're going to be trying to answer is whether people need different information, if the transaction is one that happened between related parties or not. And because I think, and I think then if I'm focusing on are the information needs different, I probably start more with the acquisition method, because we've already concluded in IFRS 3 that's the information set that satisfies the information needs of users about a BizCom transaction. And then I just think we can get into distraction with people raising quite valid points about why the nature of a transaction is different, and we should be focusing on the information content. And the second is something that I think was in one of the papers rather than the deck, which is in terms of initial reactions about where do you start, the comment that the conceptual framework that we are in the process of finalizing says that we're taking an entity approach, and this is kind of echoing what Sue was saying just a moment ago, that if I start from the perspective that it's the entity perspective rather than the shareholder perspective, then I think I probably look at what transaction has happened from the entity, the reporting entity level, and then go on to say, does it make a difference if the entity is under common control, rather than starting with common control as the defining feature.
Okay. Daryl.
So I would support what Sue said. That would be my sort of intuitive starting point, and Mary said pretty much the same. One of the emerging economy group members, and they said it later in the presentation, but I think it's worth bringing in here, expressed a slightly different view, which also talks to the way Mary just expressed it, which is even when you're dealing with the reporting entity perspective below a holding company, the nature of that reporting entity is different if it is controlled by someone else. and they felt that was what actually influenced the fact that the economics of that entity are different, and the people who are lending to that entity or investing in that entity are doing it for a different reason, knowing that it's controlled by someone else. And that would be probably the only reason I'd see myself getting into 12 at all, to be honest. I find it quite difficult otherwise to see that as an approach.
Martin?
Yeah, I would also say, for me it's more important, other information needs for users of this kind of are different from others. That is one aspect. Secondly, are these transactions different? Yeah, it could be, because they are under common control, they can be influenced by the controlling party, so it could not be at market rate, could be something off market, so it could be different. And thirdly, I think what for me is specific, also the cost-benefit consideration could be different. Because when you think about a complex kind of group of companies which have a lot of this kind of transaction, and it would be conclude that we always use the acquisition method, it could end up that they have 10, 11 kind of carrying amounts which they have to continue to do, and therefore combine that with the information needs of this specific entity, I think the cost-benefit consideration could be different. These three considerations, I think, are for me important when we come to a decision, should it be different or what kind of method we use.
And John?
Yes. I did an outreach with regard to this project 2 weeks ago in China, because this kind of transaction quite common in China. So the feedback I got is that, first of all, the stakeholders prefer one single accounting method to account for all of business combination under common control, because it's easier to be applied. If we introduce two, we have to think of what kind of factors and what kind of judgment the preparer will make, and it will produce different difficulties in practice. And the starting point, what kind of accounting method we should need, the feedback I got that the stakeholder prefer the predecessor method. There are several reasons. One is that they think that from reporting entity perspective, because the transaction actually under common control. So the transaction actually within the reporting entity, they think that it's like a internal trading. So it's better to keep the carry amount, not using the acquisition method to using fair value approach. So the reason giving here is that it's like a continuity of control. So the substance is not changed because the control is still continued. So it's better to keep the carrying amount ongoing. The second thing about information needs, and Mary mentioned, and I also listen to this kind of view during the LSH meeting. And some members also raised this kind of issue, whether the information needed. So who needs this kind of information? One is the controlling party, but actually a controlling party involving whole decision making. So actually the controlling party knows the transaction as a whole. So how about the non-controlling parties? Now, but in Chinese cases, when this kind of business combination and common control go to the decision of the board meetings of the directors, actually there is a kind of voting avoidance system there. So the controlling party should walk away. So only those minorly, non-controlling parties and non-executive directors can sit on the board to vote. Mm-hmm. So actually, those parties also know the whole transaction. They can vote, they can agree or not. So the information needs, they can be made. So this is the feedback I got. And they think that eventually this kind of information, the price, the decision making, and other available information can be supplemented by the disclosure. That disclosure. The reason, and also the third reason is that I agree with Martin's point, the cost benefit. If we go to the acquisition method, the cost is totally different with current practice. But current practice, the people are using predictive method. It's simple. They just keep the carrying amount move forward. But if we go to the acquisition method, it's a big impact, a change to the current practice. They have to using fair value to fair value, and also they have to recognize the goodwill. And then eventually they have to go to how to impair those goodwill, because impairment of goodwill has been becoming a very big problem there. So I think that these three reasons, the people prefer that one single method, the single method prefer it, the predecessor method.
Amaru.
Thanks, Hans. I'd like to first mention that the excellent job that the staff did during the recent EEG meeting. We had the opportunity to discuss thoroughly the issues that we've been through in this project, so it was a whole day discussion that I think it was extremely beneficial and really could incentivize people to share their views. Interesting that we spent quite a lot of time in the EEG meeting on the issues that we, I think, staff didn't bring back here today, because we have discussed it before, and one of them is exactly what is the objective of the project. And during that, at that opportunity, we were very clear that we were focused on the needs of the users, and we are focused on the entity itself. So the two comments that Mary made on the and others made about us driving the project on the information need of users and focus on the entity approach, and especially with the regards to the conceptual framework on the entity's perspective, it was very much clear, and I think these are two aspects that should drive this project. Like Chiantao, I discussed this in Brazil. Brazil also, those transactions are extremely common under common control. In discussing with particularly the Securities Commission in Brazil, they strongly advocate for the predecessor method. Mm-hmm. For the reasons very similar to the one expressed or described by Daryl in terms of when they are under the same group, or they also bring issues like similar to the ones Jintao mentioned, and the cost-benefit considerations that Martin stressed. However, there is diversity in practice. Mm-hmm. There is a common sense that generally the predecessor method is the used, but the diversity is in place. And staff is seeking preliminary views on preferred methods, and I share the view already expressed by others, and so Daryl, I do believe we should have only one method. I do believe the best and tested method is the acquisition method. I don't think options are the best alternative. And in my initial reaction to this is that we should have IFRS 3 business combinations, acquisition methods for everything. And eventually, we could identify some factors. That's not the discussion today. Eventually, could identify some factors that, for reasons like cost benefit or other reason, fully controlled, 100% control, no NCIs, no bonds traded, whatever, we can eventually resort to another method that could be this so-called, at this point, predecessor method. Mm. But apart from that, I think, in my view, the wisest direction for us is to really reinforce the principles on IFRS 3.
And John?
Following Amaro's point, I just would like to add another point, because under current Chinese securities law there is a listing IPO law there. If a company wants to be listed in Chinese capital market, they have to keep 3 years, you know, financial data continuously. So it's and those companies normally they will restructure first and then go to the public. So if we're going to use acquisition based method, they have to be stated the previous year's financial data based on the fair value. So it will be difficult for those companies to meet the listing, the IPO requirement, and it costs much, but difficult. They have to wait further, more 3 years, once they restrict it first, and then if they go to using acquisition method, because all of data have been updated based on fair value, and then they have to wait further 3 years. I think it's impractical, it's difficult, and it costs too much, yeah.
Just thinking further about information needs, when we, you know, picking up on Amaro's point, in IFRS 3, I haven't come back and read the basis, but I assume that we're using acquisition method because we're accounting for the fair value of what one of the reporting entities has paid and the fair value of, you know, what has been received, acquired in exchange for that transaction. And that's, you know, why we go through the cost and the trend disruption of remeasuring. And so I think maybe thinking about that as the driver, if that is correct, for the use of the acquisition method in terms of the information needs versus the transaction, some of the things Mauro was saying about no NCI, because I think it becomes more a question of do you have the same information need about what was paid and what was received? Should we always be wanting to account for the fair value of what was paid because that's relevant information to users of financial statements? It is, I think, a valid question. And if what you say is it really there was nothing paid, it's just a reorganization of the structure, maybe that's part of what helps distinguish whether there is some other group of transactions. But I think that, you know, something that's mentioned but you haven't discussed in the slides, yes, is which predecessor method on slide 8, because I think it gets very hard from an entity perspective focus to argue for anything other if you're saying you're not accounting for the acquisition transaction, the exchange of fair value for fair value. It's very hard to argue that you're pulling in transactions that happened outside the reporting entity. So, you know, the parent acquisition, you know, of sub A 24 years ago might have had, you know, some rebasing of that transaction. But right now, you're right, the practice is all over the place on whether it's the entity's carrying value, the parent's carrying value, you know, whose predecessor method, and I think the entity method might drive us very strongly to the combining entities predecessor basis rather than the controlling parent or the immediate parents.
Can we move on?
Yeah, we can move to the selection of methods. So as we illustrated in the board process, the next question for me to answer is really how to select which methods to apply to a particular transaction, and this is what we're going to discuss. And we thought of a three-step process where as a first step, we identify potential relevant factors, so characteristic of the transaction to be considered in selecting an accounting method over another. As a second step, we agree on a process to assess the impact of each of these factors on the selection of an accounting method over another. And finally, we bring step one and step two together, and we consider each factor identified in step one, applying the assessment process in step two. So starting with step one, when we try to come up with a list of potential factors, we'll look at other standard settings, guidance dealing with the accounting of business combination under common control. We look at published guidance on accounting for business combination under common control in an IFRS framework, for instance, like the Big Four manual. and also feedback received from our outreach and other discussion. And the list on slide 17 is a preliminary list of those factors we identify. Now, step two, so when we had to agree on a process to assess the impact of each of these factors, we decided to refer to the guidance in the conceptual framework. And assessing each factor will ultimately require us to answer the following question. So, which methods will provide the most useful information for the primary user of the reporting entity's financial statement at a cost that can be justified by the benefit of that information? So we are considering really a focus on useful information, but useful for who? For the primary user of what? Of the reporting entity financial statement, and again, at a cost that should not outweigh the benefit of that information. And in particular, regarding primary user, the focus in this project, in the business combination on the common control project, is on external parties rather than parties that have access to the information without relying on the reporting entity's financial statement. And of course, in accordance with the conceptual framework, we will focus on both debtor and equity investors. Now, step three, as we said before, step three is combining step one and two together. And this is where we ask ASAF and AAG member their inputs, and we appreciate your thoughts too. So for each factor identified, we'd like to discuss whether and how, in your view, the factor influences the decision about which method should be applied to a particular transaction, and if yes, why. And then from slide 25 on, we provided a brief description of the factor, and we reminded the assessment process that should be applied in each scenario. And just to give you an example of how I would like to run this discussion, if we look at the very first factor, so from slide 25, 27, so what we are going to ask you, for instance, regarding the decision-making process is, does it matter whether the transaction has been negotiated by the combining entity or directed by the controlling party? And if the answer is yes, then we need to ask ourselves the assessment question, which is, which method would provide the most useful information for the primary user of the reporting entity at a cost that can be justified by the benefit of information? And we need to ask this question when the transaction is negotiated by the combining entity and when the transaction is directed by the controlling party. And we are also asking you, are the answers to these questions different if there are non-controlling interests in the combining entity, if the transaction is affected in preparation of an IPO, or there are external lenders and other creditors, or for instance, if the only existing investor is the controlling party? So this is how the process of assessing each factor should be. And once again, before opening the floor for discussion, I'd like to share the high level feedback we received from ASAF and EEG. So first of all, ASAF members supported using the conceptual framework in assessing the factors. And many ASAF members agreed that some of the factors we identify are important in selecting an accounting method. And in particular, there was a general agreement that the purpose of the transaction is important. There was a general agreement that the commercial substance, that is the impact of the transaction on the reporting entity's cash flow, is important, that they suggested us to clarify, to be really clear on what we mean by commercial substance. And then there was also general agreement that the decision-making process is not an important consideration, because they commented that what really matter is how the transaction impact or affect the reporting entity, rather than how the decision about that transaction have been made or who made that decision. And then there were mixed view on the consideration transfer. Whereas AEG members expressed a view that none of the factors are really decisive in selecting an accounting method. So EEG members suggested that the main consideration is, once again, information needs of the external user of financial information of the reporting entity, and this should be like the driving consideration. So now let's look maybe at each factor separately, or are you?
I'd suggest we take it all together.
That is fine.
Yeah. Daryl?
So I think there's a little bit of a mindset thing that comes in here, which almost reverses back to the previous discussion we had. So, and the Emerging Economies Group got themselves there fairly quickly, I thought. And to be honest, it's a view that I would probably support. In essentially saying, and I think this is then applying the entity perspective, and saying from an entity perspective, or by one of the emerging economy groups, there is no difference to a common control transaction to any other transaction. Therefore, there is every rationale for the accounting to be the same, irrespective of these four factors, although they felt that disclosing these four factors was useful information for. And so they came down to what I think Martin's issue was that this was primarily about cost. And so the cost cost constraint becomes important when you believe that the primary users need to access information from a from externally or from internally. So if the primary users are all within the group, then cost becomes much more important because you're. If on the other hand there are external users in any one of those four categories of external users, then essentially you take the view that you are providing information primarily for the external users, and applying the same accounting approach becomes more important. And so I think that's the background to why they would have removed it. And to be honest, that would be pretty much my view.
So
I come in a similar place to Daryl, because I look at some of these tests and I wouldn't really know what it means. So what's the purpose of a transaction, for example? I'd find it hard to come up with requirements building on something like that. So I think for me it all comes back to what's the most important information. So what are the information needs? And prima facie, if there's a non-controlling interest, external bondholders or other primary users who are relying on sort of general purpose financial statements, that would make me think that acquisition accounting would make sense in the normal way. If there was some difference in the information, say for example all the funding was coming from the controlling shareholder and no external parties, then maybe that information need is not so great or non-existent, and then I think that cost consideration would come into it. So I'd always be looking at, are the information needs sort of so important coming from the acquisition method that it justifies the cost and the effort required of coming up with fair values and having two sets of numbers for accounting purposes, etc. But I wouldn't per se use these factors to help me get there.
Mary?
I think maybe similar outcome to Sue and Daryl, but having thought about it slightly differently, one thing though that is common is I didn't see the relevance of asking the question about who initiated or negotiated the transaction, because I think ultimately if there's a controlling party, if the controlling party doesn't agree, it's not going to happen. And if the controlling party thinks it should happen, it will go ahead regardless of who they said to work out the terms. So that test got me thinking, but I'll go back and say, just thinking about today's conversation has brought home to me that I'm walking away and saying IFRS 3 is the standard that accounts for the transaction. And all the specifics about how you account for what you acquired are a consequence of saying, let's account for the transaction. What did, what's the fair value of what I paid, and what's the fair value of what I got back in exchange for it? So that as long as we think it's information about the transaction that is the most relevant piece of information, then I think I'm driven to the IFRS 3 acquisition method. I think, and this is where cost does come into it, that if there are transactions, that I think it's not the accounting for the transaction that's the driver, but maybe understanding the resulting recut of interests in assets or entities or ownership or something, the kind of reorganization of entities under common control, where I'm perhaps less worried about the transaction than understanding the outcome, what's left in the entity and who owns what, then maybe on a cost-benefit basis that gets me more to some predecessor costs. But I think then I'd have to conclude that the transaction that drove that outcome is less relevant information, and I don't need fair value information about that transaction.
Nick.
And that's not tied to whether or not the transaction was at fair value. It's about the transaction not being relevant.
Thank you. I'm just asking for clarification around slide 33, where you start talking about commercial substance, and specifically talk about cash flows. And I'm just trying to get my head around cash flows. So I sit here thinking that choice of method won't actually have any impact on cash flows. Is that fair? Okay, so that may take, in some respects, lenders and creditors out of the equation, assuming they focus largely. They may focus on security of an asset, but my understanding is they largely focus around, their analysis is largely around cash flows. So is it, this is cash flow neutral, isn't it?
Isn't the point you're trying to make a slightly different one? Is the effect of the transaction to have a consequence for cash flow? So the one obvious one that comes to my head is if it changed tax, the tax payable significantly or something like that, maybe that's not a good example, but if the economic consequence of the transaction was to have an effect on cash flows, would that change the way you'd want to account for it? Yeah. So the accounting method doesn't change the cash flows, but there's something about the transaction that changes the cash flows. I think is what you're trying
to get. Getting excitement around the table, Peter?
I think Mary was on something when she said, is the most important information about the transaction or not? So the thing that I found persuasive in these discussions are the examples where you've got a 100% owned company that's going to be prepared for an IPO, and you do some shuffling around within the group. And if you do acquisition accounting there, you get different outcomes by the time of the IPO, depending on which sequence you do it in, which company you transfer to which company. And by the time you get to the IPO, the outside shareholders aren't really that interested in what the sequence was that led to that point. They're interested in what they've acquired. And you get a funny outcome if you get some pieces that have been through the acquisition method and some that are still on a predecessor basis. So it's, and at that point, probably the controlling shareholder is going to be more interested anyway in the predecessor method at the time of the transaction. So it seems to me at that point there's quite a strong case for the predecessor method, which is nothing to do with cost-benefit. It's really to do with the nature of what comes out at the point that outside shareholders come in. Now, I guess the follow-up question from that is something that Nick sort of touched on in a way, is should we focus only on whether they're NCI or should we also focus on whether there are outside lenders and other creditors? Are their needs affected in some way by the choice of method?
Martin?
Yeah. I'm confused with this step three and this decision-making process. If the controlling entity has negotiated or involved in the, I don't understand why that is important for the transaction. So how we account for that?
Maybe it doesn't.
Yeah.
It's just one of the factors we identified in other literature, and we wanted to, you know.
I think, if it is business combination and a common control, it is hard to see that the controlling entity is not anyhow involved in this kind of transaction, and it was not determined. If it is directly or indirectly, I think it doesn't matter.
That was
Gary.
Is on commercial substances. I recall the ASAF discussion. I would probably characterize as reasonably broad definition or things fit underneath commercial substance umbrella. Yes, perhaps tax reasons, but there's regulatory reasons. There's combining legal entities for collateral purposes. There's all sorts of reasons why you do it that might not affect $1 of revenue or $1 of direct costs inside the combining companies. It's just done for a larger purpose. So I think, as long as I think we have to take, a reasonably wide view of what is commercial substance, and not just in terms of the direct operations, the day-to-day combining entities.
Maybe we should have chosen a different word, but essentially these are two different considerations or potential considerations. One consideration is, okay, what is the purpose? Is this for the benefit of the combining entities, or is it for the benefit of the larger group because of operational efficiency, tax, etc.? So it's one consideration that's on the table. A different consideration is how, whether and how the transaction changes cash flows at the combining entities level. So that's what we mean here by commercial substance.
Yeah, but it might not even change at the combining entities level. It might affect the group level. And I would still say there's commercial substance to the deal.
And we are not saying that there is no commercial substance. You are not saying that,
No.
think we're agreeing.
I just think we need a reasonably wide, you know, definition of what is commercial substance.
Okay. Are all the questions answered?
Well,
not yet, but for now.
Starting to get.
Okay. Thank you very much. That concludes our board meeting, final board meeting of 2017, and we hope people will be listening in 2018 as well. Okay. Thank you.